Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I am your host, funny how that works, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock on Heritage Radio Network, we talk about my favorite subject, taste. Actually, I lied because the last two Wednesdays I was not here, and so I want to shout out a thanks to my guest hosts, Isabella Wojcik, from the James Beard Foundation, and Karen Karp from Karp Resources. You can listen to their great shows. They had fascinating guests, of course, and interesting conversations by downloading the podcast on iTunes. Today we are talking about one of my favorite places in my neighborhood to eat. I'm here with Christoph Hill, who is the co-owner and director of operations of Northern Spy in the East Village. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
We're glad to have you back here at Heritage Radio Network. One of the things that I think is so, it's going to be funny to say here sitting in Roberta, is that I love about Northern Spy is it sort of feels like I'm in Brooklyn in my own neighborhood, because it's an improbably charming, comfortable, simple, reasonably priced and delicious restaurant on East 12th Street. Tell me about how you came to be there. I know you have an unusual trajectory, sort of.
Well, the whole idea started with doing something that was actually going to be in Brooklyn, and we were searching for real estate, you know, a storefront to operate out of in 2008. And I think at that point, everybody was still feeling pretty optimistic about the economy and all that. And prices were actually really high, and we ended up finding a space in the East Village, accidentally, kind of, and we thought, well, let's do it. We're paying less in East Village than people were paying for in Williamsburg.
Have you heard that, people, that you were paying less in Manhattan than you would have for a space in 2008 in Williamsburg?
Don't shrug off Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, and you look around and there's so many more people. I mean, just think of it like, you know, mathematically, every building is a 5 or 6 story building instead of a 3 story building. So you have more people, more bodies. And it's worked out really well because we've stood out in a neighborhood. Whereas maybe in a different part of Williamsburg or Brooklyn, we would have been sort of, you know,
another one. It's funny to say.
Yawn.
But so tell me about the evolution of the restaurant, because it's a little bit different now from what it was when you opened.
Yes. The whole thing is a total case of heuristics. It's all trial and error. We just try something and it works, sort of, and so we go further in that direction. Originally, it was going to be kind of a more farm-to-table kind of prepared food takeout store. It slowly morphed as we were building it and developing the idea into more of a restaurant that had to do with our opening chef, Nathan Foote, who had more restaurant experience and my previous experience in restaurants. And sort of it's an example of how, you know, things just change naturally based on your own prejudices and experience. And then we ended up with kind of this restaurant. And then when we opened, it became more of a restaurant. And then the food got nicer. And then realized, well, we want to use these products. The prices have to be a little bit more than we anticipated. So, you know, by crook and hook, we ended up being a restaurant. And in September of last year, Hadley Schmidt joined the team. Mm-hmm. And he's a guy with a deep level of experience in fine dining in New York City, has been doing this for a long time. And he, you know, upped the ante even more with another level of food. And so we've just kind of gone that direction because it works. People respond to it well. And we're not ones to look a gift horse in the mouth. Hmm.
It's funny because I love the idea of a heuristic approach to restaurants, because I went to restaurant school, hotel school, and there it's all about creating a concept. You don't do anything. I mean, if you don't hit the ground running with an idea to open 47 restaurants exactly like that one, you don't really have a restaurant. And so one of the things that's so charming about Northern Spy is how it just feels unique to its place.
Yeah. And, you know, if you ask the staff, and, you know, if you look at my bank account,
it'd like some more planning.
it might love some more planning, but it does make for a really rich experience. And it makes people feel like they have a place where they can suggest changes and we do things. I would love to be the guy who had a brilliant idea that out of the gates was amazing. I have colleagues in the business, you know, like look at my friend Daniel Holtzman, who opened the meatball shop. Mm-hmm. Out of the gates, boom, you know what he wanted to do. Well, that's Daniel, you know, and he's incredibly clever that way. So props to him. We are much more sort of like stumbling over ourselves, trying to figure it out. But I think that the product is lovely. I think I'm very proud of what we do.
And so there's a larger vision than just feed people.
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit.
I always wanted to create a place where I was really proud of the entire experience of what we did. The kind of place we were to work, so people were proud of coming to work in this place because we served a certain product and we cultivated a certain work environment. Mm-hmm. That was interested in, you know, teaching people how to be better people, work better, use better products, respect each other, all these things. You know, it sounds like some sort of crazy, like Chapinese, like communist experience, but it's not. I mean, it's just about, you know, the restaurant business is a rough business, and there's a lot of places where you'll be taken for granted and you know, mildly abused and spat out.
And people will line up anyway.
And people line up anyway, right? And I really, you know, I have trouble sleeping at night if that's the kind of place I'm in. And so whether it had to do with farm-to-table sourcing or a certain sort of internal culture, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, it's not like, you know, we're a nonprofit and, you know, everybody's unionized and with a retirement plan. It's just we try and make the best environment possible that we can with the resources that we have.
And have you been rewarded for that with your staff and with the clientele?
Yeah, I think so. We have a very stable staff now, relatively speaking, for the restaurant industry, especially on the service side. I think cooks tend to be peripatetic by nature. They come and they go. They are looking to build a resume and make a little bit more money. So, you know, it's always hard to get cooks in New York City. But our service staff is very stable because they have a lovely thing going, and it's a very lovely environment. And that becomes the liaison with the public who see people they know, who are always there, who know them by face and know what they like. And I think that's really what makes for a really great neighborhood restaurant is a family kind of. Mm.
James Beard always said when he was asked what his favorite restaurant was, it was the one where they knew him.
Yeah, right. We were trying to be that place. Mm-hmm.
Too bad he's not around. He was on 12th Street, too. I'm talking with Christoph Hill, and we'll get back to our conversation about Northern Spy. I want to remind people listening that you can call in with questions about the restaurant or the restaurant business, because we'll get to that, or maybe about anything, maybe about the price of carrots, which we'll also get to. You can call us at 718-497-2128, or you can write us an email at info@heritageradionetwork.org. If you're listening to the podcast, or if you just prefer to communicate in 140 character sound bites, you can tweet us at TasteMattersHRN. So the food, I mean, you managed to create a nice work environment and a lovely dining environment and serve wholesome food at a reasonable price point, certainly vis-a-vis other restaurants in the neighborhood and other restaurants of the same quality. How do you do that? And or what is there a sacrifice there?
There is a sacrifice, yeah. We don't really have much of a profit margin. Hmm. And that's partly to do with the fact of, you know, the sort of the priorities that the ownership has, which includes myself, and the investors we have, who are mostly friends and family, who are sort of tolerating our do-gooder attitudes.
Interesting.
You know, we could be significantly more rapacious and try and milk it for more, but our eye is sort of on the long term. I feel like I'm building something that is going to be recognized in the industry at some point for, you know, providing a certain kind of experience, both on the inside and on the outside. So, yeah, the sacrifice is clear. And that's pretty much it. It just has to do with money, really.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, what's particularly interesting is that one of the, you know, at the Beard Foundation, we've been doing some work lately for the last few years in food system change and some of the problems, you know, even nationally but globally and right down to the regional level that have to do with decisions made vis-a-vis food. And we keep coming back to this money problem that when you treat food like a commodity, or in fact when you commodify food, that you somehow strip it of all of the things that make it a different thing. I mean, you know, not to get all, as you said, Chez Panisse on us, but but certainly there's an element of food that there's a point at which the decisions regarding money affect the quality of the food, and then, you know, the quality of you and your experience and your health even. Are you trying to create a model to counter that? Do you think there's something sustainable in that?
I think there is, in part, if you look at things like there's this new business category that I think Andrew Cuomo created this year, where you can, instead of being an LLC, for instance, you can have
an LLC, like, being a limited liability corporation.
Right. So there's, you know, there's the traditional like S corp and C corp and LLC, and there's this new thing, and I can't remember what it's called, but it's basically you're not beholden to the same strictures as far as delivering a profit to your investors. And that's actually very important, because
a B corporation?
Yeah, I think it's a B corporation, right? And so you can, I think it's after a certain amount of time, you can reclassify yourself as that. So for instance, that takes pressure off of a business to say that our primary, because even with us, I mean, if somebody wanted to be mean to me, they could sue me for failing to deliver adequate returns for reasons X, Y, and Z. Whereas if I was that B corporation, I could say that is actually not our primary obligation. Our primary obligation is to be a sustainable business. We'll deliver. Mm. It's also like the whole slow money movement,
right?
Where the primary goal is not to say that, you know, anything below 12% returns is inadequate. It's to say that we're really looking at the whole system, and everybody. Profit is important because profit drives growth, expansion, and people's salaries to have a living. But beyond that, you know, the thing is not going to be a gold mine that we're going to milk, you know, endlessly, or to mix metaphors.
Wow, interesting. So, well, I definitely think that there's a reckoning to be had when it comes to, you know, the consequences of making some decisions we make around food and the
absolutely
food that we
eat. Yeah. And I think as a small business also. I was just in a small meeting with some very interesting restaurateurs in the East Village. We're talking about kind of forming an informal group of a little association. And we're all kind of in the same boat on that, which is that it's not just about the decisions with food. It has to do with who, you know, the people who service our business, about our frustration with credit card merchant processors who, you know, who we gave $50,000 last year to credit card processors just for the simple act of transferring money from one place to another.
Right.
And that's a cost that people are very are largely unaware of on the consumer side. You know, that's somebody's salary. That's, you know, I could pay somebody a full-time position just to do the same thing if there were alternatives. So, you know, every part of the business involves, you know, we are still beholden to these large interests that dictate, you know, fundamental costs that are inarguable.
Right.
And so to at least counteract that, we throw our lot as much as possible in with the small producers, the small vendors, the local plumber, the local electrician. Unfortunately, there's no such thing as a local credit card yet, but there are things that are arising, you know.
It's so fascinating because, you know, we hear a lot about the re-regionalization of systems, whether they're food or business or whatever, but I don't think people think that that's happening in Manhattan in the same way, in small towns, in Berkeley, everything happens in Berkeley, but here we are, here you are, trying to figure out a way to negotiate through sort of the largest urban financial structure, in a more regional, super local way. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's very difficult. You know, it can be really frustrating.
Right. Well, you need to get the landlords in that organization as one of the problems, I imagine, no?
Yeah, the landlords take the long view. They don't care.
They don't have to care.
They don't have to care. Landlords are in a very good position.
Right.
Yeah, especially now.
Well, and in a city that's so overdeveloped. Yeah. Right. Yes. Fascinating. We're talking to Christoph Hill, who is, among other things, a co-owner and the director of operations of Northern Spy, which is a great restaurant, a real neighborhood restaurant in the East Village on East 12th Street. Tell me, you are also a student?
Yes, I'm also in the master's program at NYU, studying kind of a self-designed combination of nutrition and food studies. And hopefully arriving in the final year of that program.
Hopefully. Well, we will hope with you, especially
present company knows that it can take a long time.
Yes, I think everyone in this room, including our associate producer, Ashley Koziak, who is currently in it, and myself, who graduated from it, knows that it can take quite a while. What brought you back to school?
I have been involved in food production and and study since the mid-90s when I spent three seasons working on an organic vegetable farm in Northern Virginia called Wheatland Vegetable Farms with Chip and Susan Plank, who are kind of legendary in that area as as developers of regional farming. And, you know, from there went to culinary school and, you know, wandering along the way, culinary school, and spent 9 years cooking and cooking privately. And then I was sort of feeling like I wanted to draw the last leg of the triangle and get back into academics. So I enrolled and originally planning to do more on the nutrition side, and then decided that it wasn't quite a fit for what interested me. So I drifted into food studies. And then we'll finish with something that, you know, so eventually, you know, the stew will be complete. All the ingredients will be in the stew. And
that and stew will be your brain.
And
your stew
will be my brain. And, you know, hopefully somebody in the world will care.
Many people will care. Some of them are listening. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis talking to Christoph Hill.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. And before we get back into our conversation about running a small business and the price of carrots with Christoph Hill, the Director of Operations of Northern Spy, I want to remind people that restaurants are not the only business models looking for alternative ways of supporting themselves, that radio has a long tradition of a nonprofit and uniquely important business model that involves membership, and Heritage Radio Network is no different. It is now a member organization, and they're holding their first members-only party September 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. here at Roberta's Pizza, where you'll sample food from Gramercy Tavern, Del Posto, Momo Sushi, Heritage Foods USA, the founding sponsor of the station, Seat at Table, Saxelby Cheesemongers, and so much more. Cocktails by Dave Arnold. Tickets are available online at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The price includes membership to the station, and I'm a member. Ashley, our producer, is a member. We are excited about this new direction in HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Please be there. Christoph, let's talk about carrots. Tell us about the carrot incident.
the great carrot incident of July
2012. Few people may be aware, but it's important.
I think it's a badge of honor to have had a run-in with the New York Post, once Noble Paper, dragged down by News Corp. We had a lovely freelance food writer who was pitching a piece about a new generation of vegetable dishes in the city, dishes that sort of elevated vegetarian food beyond the sort of like saute of seasonal vegetables or pasta or whatever. And we were to be featured in that piece. At some point, things took a turn in the newsroom at the New York Post, and we got moved far forward in the paper from page 40-something to page 3 with a breathless article that was rather outraged about the fact that we served a carrot entree that was $18. Now, since Hadley's been with us, he's always had a really lovely vegetarian main course on the menu that people really love, especially vegetarians. They're often even vegan, I believe. So really, he goes out of his way to make a beautiful dish that a vegetarian will enjoy as much as a meat eater will enjoy it, you know, a nice pork roast or whatever it is. So they put this piece out, and it received more, I think, more, I got more Google alerts and Twitter Twitter attention about the carrot dish than I think any single other thing we've done in our history, which is, you know, partly the reach of the New York Post online.
And page 3.
Page 3. I mean, it was like you opened it, and it was just a full page, you know, sort of takedown hatchet job.
But a publicist's dream in some ways, even though...
Kind of. So, you know, irritated me for a while, and then sort of I let it sink in, and I started writing a response, and then I let that response sit on my desktop. Right. And then I thought, that's life, you know, that's life in the city. Sort of, you know, you take on a certain profile, and at some point somebody's gonna give you a little nip, and it hurts, but you sort of, the net effect is maybe for the better.
But let's talk about the dish itself, because I happen to have enjoyed it recently as part of a marathon vegetarian tasting that Hadley did for some friends that was just incredible. And one of my favorite parts of the meal, remember, this is a vegetarian meal, which for some people means you're going to go home hungry. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that. They came over and asked if for our final main course, we wanted a half carrot or a whole carrot. And we started laughing because, A, I don't know that I've ever not been able to consume a whole carrot or a bag. I wasn't really sure what was in store. We opted for half just because it was a late night and we had eaten a lot and drunk a lot. And it was so rich and delicious and satisfying that we couldn't believe it. So tell us about why a carrot dish is $18, first of all, and what that really means. Like, why carrot dishes should be $18. Let's put that out there.
Well, the first why it's $18 is, so it's the lowest priced item on our main courses. And for a restaurant to survive, we need to steer customers to a certain extent, all restaurants do, towards, you know, sort of the appetizer main course model, where we sort of, in exchange for sitting at our table, and the honor of you, of us being able to serve you, and the pleasure of being able to serve you, is sort of like, we need kind of like a base amount that we hope that you'll spend, you know, so we can pay the rent and all that. You know, it's a standard. It's nothing mendacious. It's what everybody does. And so $18, you have 3 carrots. You have organic Frica grain grown in New York State by Cayuga. You have a variety of wild greens. You have all kinds of sauces and all this. And the true cost of that dish, like everything else in a restaurant, is probably, it's a 30% food cost roughly, which is what all restaurants aim for in their markups. So ours is probably comes out to about that, which means if $18, we're, you know, talking about probably $5 worth of product. And, you know, you buy 3, you know, excellent local carrots from, you know, Pafnerhoff or, you know, Maxwell's or somebody like that, or get them from the Amish farmers at Lancaster Farm Fresh. You know, you got a couple bucks there, you got a couple bucks of Frica, you know.
And the labor. And the labor.
It's not hard to hit $5, really. So that's why it's
$18. Of course.
And the goal is to make an entree that, you know, deserves $18, and so that we can legitimately ask for. Now, before the New York Post got sand in the Vaseline, nobody had ever complained that I know, really, about the $18 carrot. I think people, like your experiences, everybody who ate it said, my God, that's a good carrot.
Quite the reverse. I would think people were delighted to see an option on a menu that allowed for that to be.
Exactly. You know, an $18, you know, it's like, it's a dish that, it's not pandering. It makes a vegetarian feel like they're welcome, they're part of the family, that they're not being given second-rate citizen status. And that's sort of, you know, like if you're on a date, like I imagine that, you know, one person can order one dish, the other person can order the carrot, and everybody feels like they're enjoying sort of an equivalent experience. If anything, maybe the carrot's even more outstanding. So that's how we get there. Now there was more to it, which is, what do I feel like that means about our business?
Well, you know, we keep hearing people, we expect to pay too little for food here, right, in this country. I mean, restaurants might be a slightly different model because not everyone is eating in restaurants, and certainly you're paying for more than just food there, and people recognize that. But even there, the 30% food cost, which is the goal, is low vis-a-vis how much goes to the farmer who actually did the hard work in the field.
And
where that money goes. And so I just thought maybe we could talk about the price of food.
Yeah, the price of food. Well, you know, nothing gets me more riled up than food media talking about the price of menus, of dishes on menus, absent, you know, context, and just largely ignoring huge, huge issues that nobody really wants to talk about. And this happens, you see it on Eater all the time. There's people who, you know, there's some well-known local media who write periodic pieces on sort of overpriced dishes around the city. And a lot of them are, you know, sure, they're kind of valid, but they're always without context. And the context is very important because there are so many hidden costs. Certainly the idea that all of us are, you know, for instance, the implication of the carrot piece was that, so we're like, we're just sitting there like ringing the cash register, like carrot, ka-ching, carrot, ka-ching, ka-ching. The truth is like very few people are ordering the carrot. So we're making, you know, we're making pennies on that carrot in the aggregate. But there's hidden costs of, you know, the fact that, you know, cooks still get paid. There's a pay scale for cooks that you know, tops out pretty low in a non-union, non-big hotel, whatever restaurant.
In an expensive city.
An expensive city to live in. And, you know, ask any small restaurateur in the city how hard it is to find cooks. If you're not operating at the, you know, like Gramercy Tavern or 11 Madison Park level, where those are real strong resume builders, if you're not a really known quantity, all of us have a terrible time finding cooks. And I believe that it's because the city is becoming too expensive for cooks to live in.
Right.
They're leaving town, I think, to just go cook somewhere else.
Well, and now that you can make a career, there's great restaurants and great food in other places where it doesn't cost an arm and a leg to live.
Or you can go work for TV shows or whatever it is. There's great options out there for people. So we're losing our cooks.
Interesting.
And you know, that's one of the costs. And the fact that that carrot dish is only $18, you know, is part of that story. There's the fact that, you know, we still live in the restaurant world is still in this kind of feudal system where servers are making, you know, with tips, you know, servers are making often $30+ an hour. And the pay scale for cooks is more like in the $12 range.
Right.
And by law, by New York State law, I cannot touch that tip pool to anybody who hasn't, you know, been involved in direct service of the food. And that's an inequity that everybody who goes, you know, the people who complain about menu prices, they still perfectly happily put down a 20% tip, which is basically a de facto surcharge on their meal that goes to the server.
Yes.
It doesn't go to a cook. It doesn't go to the person who, you know, sweated over the stove to make that. And I'm not saying that I'm aiming to, like, you know, tear the system apart and rebuild it, but, you know, like, those are all issues that nobody talks about when somebody talks about, when we breathlessly talk about the overpriced fried chicken, however. And why the fried chicken? Why is roasted chicken okay to be $20? But if it's fried, somehow it shouldn't be over $16. I mean, you see this on Eater all the time. These, you know, these, like, I mean, is that, like, you know, is that sort of like bigotry? Like, if it's, like, fried,
it's roastism. It's ovenism. Roastism.
It's ovenism, right? It's like, it's like fried chicken doesn't take any work or something. So there's all these ways that it's like nobody's really talking about the real issues. They're just sort of breathlessly exclaiming.
Right. Looking for the headline, like the Post did for you. We ran an article years ago. I mean, it's almost 20 years ago. I can't believe I can say that, about where looking at the dollar at the Four Seasons, which at the time and probably still has the most expensive entrees on any menu. It's kind of beyond reason. And then a McDonald's, a Big Mac. And even though Big Macs are so much cheaper and entrees at the Four Seasons can be $40 or $50, you know, when you factor in that it costs $100,000 to clean the tapestry on the wall and all of the things that are involved, you see a different picture, which isn't to say it's reasonable or you should be paying it, but
no, but you have to factor that in. You're like, if somebody's providing a really nice environment and there's certain costs associated with that. And it's insane. I mean, I in building Northern Spy, I sort of figured out that it's hard to do anything in the city for less than $3,000.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it is. Right. Buy a refrigerator, do some plumbing, you know, upgrade electrical. Like
clean the windows.
$3,000 gets you in the door.
Amazing. Well, I for one, am glad that you have kept that door open $3,000 at a time or yes. whatever it is and kept the prices reasonable. I look forward to the continued evolution of the concept and the menu and to see what Hadley and your team can really do. Thank you for joining me and thank you for having this conversation. I'll remind people to tweet us if they listen to this podcast and have some questions because we'll get them to the right place and we'll talk about them on air at Taste Matters HRN. I am talking next week. We're going to be with Sebastiano Cosia Castiglione, which is a mouthful, who creates wonderful mouthfuls as the owner and winemaker at Querciabella, one of the great wines of Tuscany, outside Greve in Chianti. We'll be talking about biodynamic wine and then certainly vegetarianism and someone who understands the price of carrots. He enjoyed the carrot at Northern Spy with me just a few weeks ago. Until then, eat something delicious and pay what it costs.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.